afternoon. It's Tuesday, October 28th, 2003, and coming to you live from WGMU and George Mason University, Fairfax, Virginia, this is Conflict. Good afternoon, hello, and welcome to Episode 9 of Conflict. I'm Sean Dunning. Every week on this program, we explore and uncover perspectives and examples of effective, constructive approaches towards addressing the inevitable conflicts that we all face in life. Today, the youth of the future, now. We will explore the realm of conflict associated with youth and children in today's world. We'll learn about how youth are affected by various types of conflict, and moreover, we'll hear some examples of how youth are actively contributing in constructive ways to address divisive conflict. We are joined in the studio today by Mr. Michael Shipler, who is an expert on youth and conflict issues ranging from U.S. immigration to child soldiers in war-torn developing countries. Mr. Shipler has studied and worked with issues affecting youth all over the world, from Cambodia to Northern Ireland to East Timor. He holds a BA in political science and in 1999 received the Stephen H. Miller Award for exemplifying the ideal of political involvement and social service. In 2001, he authored a book entitled The Dancing Countries and Other Stories. Today, Mr. Shipler coordinates children and youth programming at the International Conflict Resolution Organization mentioned so often on this program, Search for Common Ground. Welcome to the studio, Michael.
Thanks, Sean. It's great to be here.
I should mention that Michael's not just a colleague, but he's a good friend, so it's a real pleasure to have him in the studio today. And we tend to have conversations on subjects along these lines quite often, so hopefully we will just kind of continue that on the air today and everyone can join in. But I would, Michael, like to concentrate as much as possible on this issue of children and youth in conflict. And there's kind of two different ways I want to kind of go with this. There's youth, you know, how youth are affected by conflict, and then what are youth doing about conflict? How do they react to it? How are they playing a part in the constructive approach towards dealing with conflict? So perhaps if we could start out just by talking a little bit about what is the state of youth and conflict these days?
Well, the first thing that we ought to talk about actually along those lines is about the definition of youth and the definition of child as well.
Great.
In order to kind of clarify what I'm talking about, the International Convention on the Rights of the Child defines anybody under the age of 18 years old as a child. That is the international standard that's been accepted by just about everybody. The term youth is a lot broader. It's a construct that most societies have, and each society defines differently.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, youth is defined by actually a life stage and a set of roles that young people play.
As opposed to age.
As opposed to age. Usually it's defined by, say, relationship, by marriage. Before somebody's marriage, they are still a youth. Sometimes it's defined by economic standing. Before they have a profession or job that actually allows them a certain amount of economic stability and independence, they're still a youth. These are all things that are profoundly disrupted, of course, by armed conflict.
Mm-hmm.
So when you ask me, you know, what is the state of youth in conflict, and I would actually broaden it to say, what is the state of children and youth in conflict? The overwhelming experience is that the natural psychological and social development of children and youth is completely disrupted by conflict. Because, for the most part, development is defined by roles as well. In most cultures, those roles themselves are completely disrupted. So, for example, you have a kid who is, you know, 12 years old in, say, Eastern Congo, who gets abducted into one of the many armed factions in that part of that country. He loses his opportunity to go to school. He loses his opportunity to play. He loses his opportunity to have meaningful, ongoing relationships with adults, particularly his parents. He loses opportunities to learn a vocation of some sort. His entire set of roles is completely disrupted.
And this is the thing. He loses his childhood, it sounds like what you're saying.
Exactly. He loses his childhood. And this is the overwhelming experience of young people who are mired or affected by conflicts around the world.
What are some places where that takes place? I mean, it's hard for us to imagine, perhaps, for instance, in the United States, you know, 14-year-olds in war. When you talk about these situations, where are you talking about?
Well, there are approximately 40 ongoing armed conflicts around the world that have some sort of a political dimension to it, although many armed conflicts are actually primarily, entirely resource and economic based. Children and young adults play a role in all of those conflicts around the world. There isn't a single conflict that doesn't have young adults involved. Almost all of the conflicts have children involved as soldiers, but not just as soldiers, also as gang members and militia. So some places, well, Congo is one which has had a massive war with many, many children. Nobody knows exactly how many, but over 10,000 involved as soldiers. In Burma, which has an ongoing conflict between the government, military government's army, and a whole range of different armed factions representing different ethnic groups and an opposition pro-democracy group, has around 70,000 children who are actually soldiers. Those are child soldiers.
So meaning less than 18?
Under 18 years old, right. Child soldier is defined as anybody under the age of 18 who has an involvement with an armed faction. Not all of them carry weapons. They play a multitude of roles in armies. But 70,000, that's the largest crisis, the most number of soldiers involved in any conflict at all. And about 60,000, according to Human Rights Watch, approximately 60,000 of those soldiers are in the government army and 10,000 on the range of opposition groups.
And we're not just talking, you know, rebel guerrilla groups. We're talking about actually sanctioned official government militaries?
Yeah, absolutely. In some cases, they are recruited legally as part of actual legal recruitment strategies. In other cases, they are kind of illegal, kind of under the table members of those groups. So they may play, for example, a role as a cook, you know, where they actually cook the food for the soldiers, and they're involved. They travel with the troops. They do everything with the troops, but they're not officially conscripted into the armies. But they are actually rather kind of associated members. The other roles that a lot of, especially young women, play is as sex slave and as wife. So there are a lot of reports of armies in different places actually forcibly recruiting young girls to be part of their circle, and they end up kind of being rewarded at times to different soldiers as, you know, as wives, of course, against their will.
Now, let's bring it back. A lot of our listeners, well, actually, we have listeners all around the world right now. Because this is webcast over WGMUradio.com, we can get statistics and find out who's listening. And we've got, just last week, someone was listening from Ghana. There were people listening from Brussels, others in Germany, Japan. And so we do have a worldwide audience. I think it's fair to say most of our audience is right here in the United States, and many of which are right here around Washington, D.C. area. I'm wondering, how can we bring this home a little bit and make it a little more tangible, if you will, to those who maybe aren't so up on these issues in places like Congo and East Timor?
Well, I can tell you a story about a young man who I got to know. I'm going to just call him by his initial to protect him. His name, we just called him G. I was working at a refugee camp that was actually set up here in the United States. In Fort Dix, which is a military base in New Jersey, and they converted a segment of it to a camp to process approximately 5,000 Kosovar refugees who came into the United States during the 1999 war in Kosovo when the U.S. had attacked. And I think it must have been my third or fourth day there. I went to a meeting where somebody had organized to bring a group of American teenagers from a local high school there in New Jersey to meet with a group of Kosovar teenagers just to help them have a sense of what they were in for. You know, coming into an American high school without speaking much English, although a number of them did speak English, without having ever been here, and many of them had never been out of even Kosovo, much less, you know, broader Yugoslavia. And so I went to this meeting, and I introduced myself, and I said, you know, I'm going to be setting up a youth program here in the camp, and, you know, and I'd be interested in chatting with any of you and talking to you about what your experiences are in helping you through this time that's so difficult. These were young people who had been forced from their homes by the Serbian army, had walked to Macedonia and had been living in Stankovic 2, which was a camp in Macedonia, and had gained the opportunity to be resettled in the United States. And so I was, you know, working with them, and I started to walk out, and this young man kind of came up, and he backed me up against the wall, and I'll call him G. And he said, he said, Michael, he said, I want to talk to you. His eyes were wide open, and he was kind of almost breathing heavily, almost hyperventilating. He was very anxious, very filled with rage. And so I said to him, you know, okay, let's talk. What's going on? And he said, I was in the KLA, which is the Kosovar Liberation Army, the army that was fighting against the Serbian government. And I said, how old are you? He said, I'm 17. And I asked him, I said, well, you know, why have you left the KLA? And he said, well, the leadership actually asked me to leave. They said, go and get an education, he said. And then his eyes went wide with rage, and he said, I'm going to go to military school here in America. I want to learn to fight, and I want to learn strategies. I want to be able to go back to Kosovo and kill every Serb that I see. And I, you know, I was like 21 years old. I'd never heard anybody
say such
a thing.
That's what it meant to get an education?
Yeah. And that's what an education for me. I'd never heard anybody say such a thing. How would this young man whose English was flawless, I mean, he could be in this conversation, and his English was flawless. How could he be so filled with rage? My reaction was to tell him that he probably shouldn't say that kind of thing around here. In the States, people, you know, it may be acceptable in some arenas, but he wasn't going to get away with saying that. So I started to say to him, I said, you know, you don't want to say that. He said, in America. And he cut me off. He said, in America, if I meet a Serb, I'll kill him too. And I said, wait a minute. We need to have a longer conversation about this. And I came to understand, when I stepped away from it, I actually came to understand the following thing. G was asking me for help. He didn't seek me out just to threaten Serbs. He was seeking me out. And I have come to interpret and understand what he said was as, I am in so much pain from the rage that I have that I need to find some way of coping with that. And so he and I spent a lot of time together, you know, talking and working. You know, he was brilliant. And I got him a hold of Nelson Mandela's autobiography because we were talking all about finding the humanity in your enemy and what does it mean to find the... He said, look, Mandela won his battle. He wasn't non-adversarial necessarily. He wasn't a pacifist either, but he never failed to see the humanity in this enemy. And nobody had anything to do in this camp. They were just sitting. So G read this book. And he was one of the last people to leave. Very agitated, very traumatized. His girlfriend had been killed. His cousin had been killed. He was missing half his family, like everybody was there. He was in the heart of his trauma. And so, you know, he was getting more and more agitated as time went on. And I remember this one evening late in the time where we had a concert. We brought in some Albanian musicians. There was a famous woman whose name I've forgotten. I'd never heard of her before. But the refugees were thrilled and so excited about having her there. And we filled up this room. It was actually a chapel of a church, and everybody was dancing through the aisles, and people were weeping, and they hadn't been allowed to hear Albanian music live. And I went outside to escape the heat, and I saw G, and he was standing there with one of his friends, and he had his two hands, his hands out by his sides, and he was dancing. It was dark. He was all, the two of them were all alone, and they were just dancing, listening to the music. And he saw me, and he said, "Michael," he said, "how long until they stop playing?" I said, "They'll play till 10, G." And he said, "Yes." Like a little boy, this flash of little boy just arose in him. He said, "Yes." And he went on, and he looked at me. He went on dancing, and then he looked at me again, and he said, "Michael, it's been 5 years since I've heard Albanian music live." And then he went back to his dance. And this is a real kid who was a real child soldier, who was filled with the ideology of hatred, who chose to be a soldier, but is also a child, and is also seeking, and is also trying to figure out who he is, what he is, grappling with his identity. So maybe that humanizes it a little bit. You know, G was one of the most important people influencing my choices of what I want to do in my life.
That story really seems to, like you say, kind of bring out the innocence, if you will. I mean, despite his history as a child soldier, I mean, he's still just a kid. You know, the world is complex enough, you know, for adults. And children, when they're faced, you know, with having to make choices themselves, I mean, a choice like becoming a soldier, for crying out loud. What is that like? You know, you said G, for instance, volunteered to be a soldier. I intuitively would think that child soldiers are more coerced or forced into it, but if they're actually making, some of them are making choices to do this, what's the context like? Why would they choose to be a soldier?
Well, you have a combination. I mean, a lot of people like to think of all child soldiers as being forcibly recruited or abducted. Mm-hmm. And you do have a lot of conditions, and many, many of them are. I mean, you have situations like in the north of Uganda where the Lord's Resistance Army has actually taken entire schools of children. But many children also volunteer for a whole host of conditions. I would call them push factors in some ways, because volunteer makes it sound very innocent, like he's going to pick up trash, you know. When I say volunteer, he's made a choice using his own agency, but with a whole set of coercion and pressures on him or her that push them toward that opportunity and that option that seems to be to them the only things that they could do. There seem to be no other choices for them to make. Those factors include things like economic factors. They're hungry. There's no food, and there's no way of gaining food except for through the military. Other factors include revenge. Their entire family's been killed by one group, and they're so filled with rage that they want to join another. Other factors include ideology, which is the case of this young man. I've met people, you know, who are former child soldiers in rebel groups in Central America, who chose out of a sense of justice that, you know, that they, a belief system that they had. There are others who choose to do it for protection, that, you know, if they don't, they're going to end up being perceived as being part of one army or another, and they're in quite a lot of danger. So you have a whole wide range of push factors. When I say that they volunteer, I wouldn't say that choice is a free choice necessarily. They're coerced by the factors and the conditions of their society.
Sure.
So it's not so automatic as...
Right, right. Well, you know, as you're mentioning these points, I can't help but think about parallels with gangs in the United States. Do you see that?
I do. It's funny. I've had some long conversations with the experts on this issue. I think that the biggest comparison has to do with the use of violence as a tool and a way of gaining status. I think that in the U.S., young people join gangs for also a whole host of reasons, and often are choosing to join gangs because they feel like they have no other option. And so this is another...
But certainly they get that belonging and security, and right. all these needs are met.
Exactly. I was going to say that I think that young people join gangs here because they have gaps in their life that are left by other things. Sometimes there's a gap in family and belonging. Other times they have very good families and they're, you know, in wonderful, loving family environments, but they are lacking an opportunity to gain status in, you know, in their communities, or it's dangerous. They need to protect themselves. Mm-hmm. I've talked to young gang members who will talk about, you know, choosing to join because they felt like they needed to have somebody to watch their back. The other thing is that when I talk, those people I'm just mentioning was not like in a gang like the Crips and the Bloods, which is the famous kinds of gangs mm-hmm. that we know, but lots of times young people form what they call gangs, but are really, you know, a group of friends who have each other's backs.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, historically speaking, you know, the term gang didn't necessarily refer to a violent group. It was, or at least I've heard about it that way, like, you know, like gang of friends, or, you know, hanging out with my gang, you know, just kind of my group of friends. But now, you know, let's kind of change the angle here a little bit. We discussed, you know, how conflict is affecting children and youth, particularly violent war type of conflict in other countries, as well as even comparing that with gangs here. What about the flip side? What are these youth doing to be constructive about these types of issues?
In almost every zone of conflict, you can find groups of young people that have formed of some way mm-hmm. to respond to the violence and the things that are happening in their environment. They have done this for a whole number of reasons. Usually, those groups are very small. They don't call themselves an NGO or a nonprofit organization.
Right.
They are just, you know, we're the group of friends who decided not to end up in the army, or we're the group of friends who decided to help our little brother and sister go to school, or to, you know, to do whatever they can do to resist the things that are happening to them,
mm-hmm.
To help foster resiliency with each other. They exist all over the place. Sometimes, if they're lucky, they're able to connect up with people who have a little bit of power and some resources and money and capacity to really help them take their ideas and their dreams and actually make them into real programs.
Mm-hmm.
There's an example of a group in Colombia. They call it, it's called the Movimiento del Niño para la Paz, the Movement of the Child for Peace. And I don't actually know anybody from this group, but they, from what I understand, their goal has been to open space for children to be protagonists for building peace,
mm-hmm.
how they frame it, and that they actually want to say that the war in Colombia is a war of adults, and that children need to protect their own rights, since adults won't, and that they want to actually play a role in building peace. There are groups like this all over the world, and I could give more and more examples of it as mm-hmm. I will give more examples as we continue to chat.
I'm struck by what you just said and thinking about you know, role models. Who's looking up to whom? You know, or should the are there situations here where the adults could be learning from the youth, from the children?
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the things that is amazing is that sometimes you find, well, youth especially, taking on a role of leadership that adults really admire. And they're able sometimes, because they're not so enmeshed in the broader political environments mm-hmm. that they're living in, they're able to make some, you know, statements or do some things that adults couldn't. There's a group that I had the privilege of working with for some time in Cambodia. It's called Youth for Peace. In Khmer, they call it Yut Vet Sandepiep. And they was formed by four young people, two of them in their mid-20s and two of them in their, I think they were probably in their early 20s or late teens when they actually created the organization. And Youth for Peace, they started under a tree, literally. And it was started by this one gentleman by the name mm-hmm. of Ren. I can give his name. And Ren just had a vision. He just said, you know, we can't be living like this. you know, Cambodia, just I'll give a 2-second history lesson on Cambodia. Cambodia, after the end of the colonial period, fought a very bitter war that the United States was involved with between a group, the Khmer Rouge, and the U.S.-backed Lon Nol government,
mm-hmm.
which led to the Khmer Rouge actually won the war. It was a communist Maoist regime that had a philosophy of total agrarian revolution. And upon taking over the country on April the 17th of 1975, emptied all the cities and began to kill and began a genocide in which they killed almost everybody who had any education, spoke a foreign language, had any kind of resources or money. 2 million people were killed approximately. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some debates about that, but 2 million people were killed out of a population of 8 million, which is quite significant. The country was left without any intellectual class.
Mm-hmm.
And the Khmer Rouge ruled a slave state, basically. Everybody else who survived was a slave. And you can see people's resumes, and they'll put, you know, 1972 to 1975 teacher, Kampong Sam province, 1975 to 1979 slave laborer, you know.
They put that Batambang on their resume, that they were a slave?
They put slave laborer, Batambang, and they were, you know, working in the rice fields. And it was a crime against humanity matched only maybe by Mao and Stalin and Hitler. You know, it's in that category. Ren was among the many, 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 many people who lost family, and he lost both his parents actually in the last days of the genocide. The Vietnamese took over in 1979. They actually occupied the country until the early 90s, when the UN Transitional Authority came, and actually United Nations Transitional Authority began to rebuild the country after basically 30 years of war and genocide and occupation and neglect. And so the country is you know, and it, the war continued until the late 90s, until 1998. And the Khmer Rouge continued to fight in the north. So it's really, the country really has only 5 years of being out of war. And so it's rebuilding entirely. This group of young people who grew up in the midst of this, Ren lost his family and grew up an orphan. Another fellow by the name of Ket, he grew up with family, but when the Vietnamese took over, spent well over a year running through the forests and the mountains, eating branches off trees. When I would travel with Ket through the countryside, he would just take a branch off a tree and be like, "Hey, Mike, eat this." and then two other young people, Makara and Muni, and they had this vision that there was some other role for youth. That youth were actually not the hope of the future and all that, but they were the here and now. They were the ones who weren't as devastated in some ways or wrapped up in what had happened. They were just purely, everything had happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was their responsibility now, here and now and today, to actually transform Cambodia's way of dealing with violence. And so they set upon this slow course of rebuilding the culture, of rebuilding the values, of rebuilding moral character, and they work with other youth. They started under a tree holding discussions about relationships between Cambodia and Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Very dangerous work, actually. Mm-hmm. They got shut down, they had this and that happened to them, but they worked. And then they were very lucky, they got connected with an NGO, a Cambodian organization, that gave them an opportunity to actually have a space. And they got a little bit of funding from two groups, one American Friends Service Committee and the other one the Mennonite Central Committee, and they got $1,000. With $1,000, they operated for 1 year.
Wow.
They worked for 300 youth doing peace-building conflict resolution trainings and education opportunities. They reused
masking. And they were completely self-organized. These were just youth working together.
Yep. They just had this idea. They wanted to do it. They were victims of war. They were participants of it. They wanted to change it. They wanted to change the environment. Wanted to have an impact on the environment that they were living in. And they knew that it was their generation's job.
Mm-hmm.
And they still believe that. And they're still operating. And I got a letter the other day from Ren, and he was off you know, facilitating a meeting with a former president of Indonesia. I mean, wow. He has gone in, you know, they have gone in 4 years from, you know, being sitting on straw mats in the garage of another organization to, you know, a, you know, meeting with the president of the World Bank. And I mean, and there are still youth, and there's, you know, and the thing is great about them is that the participants who come through their program, many of them end up as actual leaders and then staff members. So mm-hmm. it's fully youth-run, youth-initiated, youth-oriented, youth-owned. You know, young people own it themselves. It's theirs. It's their generation's movement.
Wow. That's quite inspiring.
I'll talk more about them later as we continue. There's a lot more to tell about this amazing group. And they're just, the thing about it that's great is that they're mm-hmm. just one of, you know, hundreds. I mean, I've been amazed that I find youth groups all over the place mm-hmm. who are doing this work. Not all of them are so...
How about in the United States?
In the U.S., there are groups of young people who form. The thing is that one example I can think of off the top of my head mm-hmm. is a group here in Maryland that's formed in a school in uh-huh. John F. Kennedy High School, who are working for their peers in zones of armed conflict. They're called Advocates for Children in the Crossfire. And they do all kinds of work raising awareness about children who are child soldiers. And they were actually formed out of a conference organized by the United States Department of Labor. And they're really working on behalf of their peers around the world. You do find groups of young people, young adults, who are working on gang reduction work. I mean, there are many former gang members who have kind of gotten out of that life mm-hmm. or have signed peace treaties or whatever with rival gangs and decided they want to do something that's a little bit different and really help, you know, keep their younger brothers and sisters of equivalent ages from getting so hooked up and connected into this stuff. So they do exist. Mm-hmm. They do exist.
Well, I'd like to, Michael, first of all, you're a great storyteller. You've got a lot of stories to share and look forward to hearing some more. We're going to take a little break, listen to a little music, and when we come back, I'd like you to maybe talk a little bit about the book that you wrote a couple years ago.
Okay.
And I know you weren't expecting me to ask you about that, but as a storyteller and now a published storyteller, I'd like to explore some of what that was all about. So we're listening to Conflict here on WGMU from George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. And we're going to take a quick break and return with our guest, Michael Shipler.
She grabs her magazines, she packs her things, and she goes. Leaves the pictures hanging on the wall. She burns all her notes, and she knows she's been held to a few years, but she feels this old.
And welcome back to Conflict on WGMU, coming from George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. And we've got a little music in the background here that we're going to stop in just a second. How about that? Let's try that again. Welcome back to Conflict here at WGMU at George Mason University, Fairfax, Virginia. And we're joined in the studio today by Michael Shipler, who is an expert on youth and conflict issues around the world, particularly dealing with child soldiers and in war-torn societies all over the world. And Michael is also a published author. Michael, maybe you could share a little bit about this book you wrote a couple years ago.
Well, the book I've written is called The Dancing Country and Other Stories. It's a collection of short stories. There are 10 in the book. They were written over the course of probably 6 years. The first two of them, actually, I wrote when I was 17, at least the early drafts of it, when I was in high school. And then was writing all the time from then until I was 23 when I had this opportunity to put this out. It was a very small publishing company. Mm-hmm. And somebody I knew who was working there had known some of my work had offered me to do this, put together and submit to their committee. and to do a regular book contract with them. And so I said, well, all right, why not? And I did it, and it was a thrill.
What kind of stories?
There are really a wide range of stories. I've had people kind of describe them as being like – somebody described them as being like fables, although I don't necessarily think of them that way. But they're stories about all kinds of different places and different kinds of people all over the world. I have a lot of different pieces of tales that I've heard in different places I've been. And I kind of recombine them and remix them and change them up a little bit and put them together into the short stories. So.
And what's the kind of target age group for this book?
Oh, I suppose it's, adults, but
yeah.
I mean, I didn't think about it as a book for youth or anything like that any more than I was a youth myself, so.
Very interesting. Well, if you're interested in checking it out, the title is The Dancing Countries and Other Stories by Michael Shipler, and it's available on Amazon.com, right?
Yeah, it's available on Amazon, or you can probably order it through bookstores, but they don't usually carry it.
Yeah, you never know.
You never know.
Go check out the local borders. I'd like to move on here. And, Michael, if you wouldn't mind me asking a few personal questions.
Absolutely.
You are an amazing individual in terms of all your experience working with youth, trying to make this world just a little bit better place than it was before you were here. And certainly that's evident with all the different experiences you've had with different organizations and many just self-directed initiatives towards working with youth in conflict. In a very simple sense, what motivates you?
Well, it's always a hard question to answer. People ask me that a lot, and I don't... I don't actually have a good answer for it. I think at this point what motivates me are the amazing folk who, despite all the odds, are coming out the other end of conflict determined and committed to changing their environment and building peace or protecting themselves or protecting their peers. And yet they have so few connections to resources and other people who are doing the same kind of things and feel so isolated. And I'm in this, amazing position in the world and being from the U.S. and having the opportunity to move across all kinds of lines that I can build bridges for them to people who have resources. I don't know if that's really a personal answer or not, but that's what fuels me now.
Mm-hmm.
That's what fuels me now.
Let me ask you a little tougher question.
Yeah.
How will you know that your life was successful? In other words, do you have any ambitions, specifically? I know this is kind of putting you on the spot here, but how do you gauge, the goals in your life and what you want to accomplish?
Well, I often tell people that I have a list of things that I'd like to do. So I don't think about kind of places I want to go.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that, I dream of doing is to create a network for these youth groups so that they have access, a real place for them to belong and real access to resources and opportunities and connections that will strengthen them and help them do things together that they couldn't do on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And I dream of helping that set of voices, of opening spaces for that set of voices to contribute to all the technical, professional people who are working on child protection and youth development in the world and through the various international organizations like our own, Search for Common Ground. But so that we all suddenly have all kinds of access to young people who are taking on these leadership roles, and so that their role as leader becomes a really natural one. I don't know whether, there's so many things I want to... That's a very professional answer about what I want to succeed in this field. I mean, I also dream of, continuing my writing. I dream of building an amazing family and, continuing the amazing relationship that I have with my wife. And there's a lot of... And there are a lot of other things I'd love to achieve. I don't know how that is as an answer, but
well, you know, since you work with kids so much, youth and children of all ages, certainly I imagine they look up to you. So it's interesting to know, you know, kind of where you're going with things, and I'm sure some of them are listening right now. So
the thing that's the key though about mm-hmm. being an adult ally to young people isn't necessarily about modeling the behaviors, although it is modeling dreaming and modeling ambition and modeling entrepreneurialism. Those things are aspects of it, but really to reach young people, the key is listening to their dreams and asking them what their dreams are and hearing those things and then following them and giving them access to those, to the possibilities of following those dreams.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that, you know, the question you've asked me is a question I'll ask, that we ask them too in the various environments I've been in all kinds of ways. But, you know, the key to it is about your focus on them and being able to help them see their own hearts,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily try to follow others.
You know what I always struggle with is reconciling, you know, my kind of my place, like the place of one individual in this whole effort. I mean, you mentioned earlier that there are hundreds and hundreds of programs, maybe more, around the world doing very constructive things with youth or without youth, certainly working towards conflict resolution type approaches to doing things. And, you know, I'm always amazed about, you know, hearing about new programs that I didn't know of before. And it seems like there's a lot to be done in terms of maybe organizing and informing people, and getting the word out about things that are being done. And one kind of goal that I have with this radio program is to help inspire people with examples.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can talk all day about theories and, you know, ideas about what ought to be done or what might be done or what the problems are. And I think kind of for the everyday individual out there who maybe isn't well read on different conflicts around the world or even here, but rather I think there's some people who are kind of pessimistic, kind of cynical about human nature, you know, that, you know, kids these days or, you know, et cetera, you know, all the problems. And when one suggests, well, there's non-adversarial or collaborative ways to go about addressing conflict. It doesn't have to be a fight. It doesn't have to be a win-lose. Inevitably, the next question from that skeptical person is, oh, yeah? Oh, give me an example. Prove it to me. And I was wondering if you could maybe, with your wealth of experience, share a few examples of effective approaches towards dealing with conflict that are nonviolent, that have been effective.
I'll talk a little bit about Youth for Peace again in Cambodia,
sure.
because they think that the model that they've developed there is really quite a special one. They have three programs that all of the youth interact with. They're now divisions, essentially, of the organization, although when I was there, they were just activities. The first is about building a sense of self. They actually put everybody who comes into the program through a workshop where they have to address issues of self, of morality, moral character,
mm-hmm.
about the role of them, youth and themselves, their own role in their families, in their community, in their country. They work to develop what they call in Khmer, the word is salatoa. I hope I got it right. But it's a word for morality, but it's an active word. It's a verb for morality. It's something that you carry and have. It's about your whole character, not just a belief system. That's their first step. Very, very rooted in Cambodian culture.
Mm-hmm.
Their second step, then once young people go through that, the participants, they get access to a whole bunch of different other kinds of workshops, including conflict resolution, kind of cooperative problem-solving stuff, peace education, where they talk about what are the roots for building peace in Cambodian culture that maybe are in the, you know, in the roots, in the old traditions of our people that maybe have been damaged or destroyed in the war,
mm-hmm.
and genocide and occupation and colonialism. And then they do leadership development, where they actually create opportunities for young people to develop some concrete skills in leaders. So talk about what does it mean to be a leader, good leader, and a moral leader. And Cambodia has not mm-hmm. ever had a shortage of leaders.
Well,
Pol Pot was
a
leader,
mm-hmm.
and I'll give you an example.
Uh-huh.
With the leadership workshop, we'd ask kids, you know, what is the what are the major issues that you're facing, and what do you want to do about it? And then they would actually do them. And when I was doing this, I remember one group of young folk decided to do a workshop on good driving. and I walked in and I thought, this kid was a genius, the one who was leading this thing. His name was Banak. And I kind of thought, good driving. He wants to do a workshop on good driving. I scratched my head and said, well, what's this all about? And I walked in one day, and there it was. They had this whole group of youth in our youth center, with pictures of motorbikes. And, I mean, they had done this three-day training on this thing. And I went upstairs. Ren came in, and he says to me, Mike, I'm so amazed at what Banak and the others are doing. And I kind of thought, what are you talking about? I thought, well, hey, everybody has their own way of doing this leadership stuff. And mm-hmm. I came to understand that actually this was not just a workshop about good driving. This was a workshop about getting out of gangs, because the gangs in Cambodia are motorcycle gangs, and they drive crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And so the youth themselves created their own euphemisms, their own metaphors out of their own experiences to talk about the issues that were facing them. Because they needed to. They wouldn't have worked probably to do a workshop on gang reduction. I happen to know that young man's older brother had been in a gang and got out of a gang through this program, through what I just described. And this older brother, his name was Panit. And one day we were doing some sort of a public education performance, sharing a wooden stage with another group. And we showed up a little bit early, and we had left some stuff at the stage, and we were doing some other things. And we came back, and the other group had been furious with us, and they said, oh, we shouldn't let you use the stage because it's our stage and you're not paying for it. And Panit was enraged. I mean, he was like steaming mad. And he said, if I hadn't gone through Youth for Peace, I would have burned their stage down. And believe me, I know he would have. He was a tough kid.
Wow.
But he didn't. He recognized that he had choices, and he made a different choice. And he was doing public education on weapons reduction. So, the choices were, weapons reduction, public education, or burn the stage down. And he made his choice. So, the thing about it, the approaches that I think are most wonderful and they cut across cultures are those in which people just believe in the youth they're working with, believe in them, and believe in what they can do, and ask them what they can do, ask them what they want to do. Believe me, they'll do things that surpass anybody's. Any adults, and even their own imaginations.
Fantastic story. Since we're talking about kids today, there's a song that I want to share, and this was actually written by a guy out in Arizona, and a few years ago, I had the opportunity to travel in an international organization called Up With People. I traveled with 130 people from 25 different countries, and we went all over the place, and we lived with host families, and I was hosted with this dear old couple in a small town of Patagonia, Arizona, and this woman, Virginia Benderley is her name, told me a story about this local guitar player, this guy, and this is a very small town of like 200 people or something in rural Arizona, and this guy, it was a kind of a musician, and people would hire him to play at birthday parties and things like this, and he really specialized in children's songs. Very talented guy. Well, my host mother, if you will, Virginia, noticed this guy and was really impressed and asked if she could get a CD. And he said, well, I don't have any CDs, And she said, well, why not? You're so great. And he said, well, I can't afford it. Producing something like that. And so she ended up footing the bill and produced this guy's CD. I believe this is the title track. It's called Nobody Knows. By Eric Hansen. I'm going to share it with you right now.
How many numbers are there in the world?
Nobody knows.
Nobody
knows.
How could a boy want to kiss a girl?
Nobody knows.
Nobody knows. Why does a mailman know my name? How come my hamsters all look the same? When the tub is empty, why does the ring remain?
Nobody knows.
Nobody knows.
Nobody knows.
Nobody knows. How many stars are there in the sky?
Nobody knows. nobody knows, nobody knows. I lie in bed at night and wonder why, nobody knows, nobody knows. Who ate that last piece of chocolate cake? When something falls, why does it always break? Why is it better to give than take? Nobody knows, nobody knows, nobody knows, nobody knows. If God made everything, then who made God? Nobody knows. Where did the lightning bug get its glow? Nobody knows, nobody knows. If you find out, I wish you'd let me know, 'cause nobody knows, nobody knows. Why does a mailman know my name? How come my hamsters all look the same? When the tub is empty, why does a ring remain? Nobody knows, nobody knows. Nobody knows, nobody knows. Who put the rainbow in the rainbow trout? Who on earth invented sauerkraut? When I grow up, I'm gonna find out all about these things that nobody knows, nobody knows, nobody knows, nobody knows. And I'm gonna tell my kids about all those things that nobody knows, nobody knows. Nobody knows, nobody knows, nobody knows, nobody knows.
And we just heard from Eric Hansen on his title track of a new CD called Nobody Knows. And this guy is just some your everyday random guitar musician in a small town in Arizona. And some very nice old lady helped to produce a CD for him. And now we could hear that and many kids around the world as well.
The great thing about that song is that Eric really captures, Eric his name is, right?
Yeah.
He really captures the inquisitiveness of children in that. And that kids sometimes can ask questions in ways that nobody else can. And adults can't, even young adults, even youth often can't. They're willing to put themselves out there to ask what's happening to them. And great programs that address the kids who are involved in war and who are suffering from trauma and are displaced and this and that are the ones that help kids give kids ability to find language for what they're going through, or images for what they're going through. There are programs that use photography to help kids document their lives, theater to actually talk about what's happening to them, storytelling, something that they can kind of gain narrative and access to their own narratives.
You know, neither of us are very old here, but I often wish I could kind of go back and be, you know, an 8-year-old with kind of the simple mind, not realizing the complexity of the world. And it seems like there's a lot of not genius, but certainly a lot of genius and just the simple decisions that kids can make when they don't know. There's some great quote, I forget who it comes from, basically it's something along the lines of children's ability to endure stems from their ignorance of alternatives.
Well, you know, there's a lot of literature on resiliency and the things that kids, the factors of resiliency that allow kids to survive trauma. Mm-hmm. And among those are the ability to have narrative, ability to know what's happening to you, also an ability to be, philanthropic isn't quite the word, but an ability to be helpful to others and to help other people.
Mm-hmm.
And to do things that are bettering your own environment. And the last one is an ability to dream. And a dream of a normal life. Even those kids who are in refugee camps, who are suffering immensely, can dream of going home someday or going somewhere else or being a doctor, being a lawyer. Those are the kids who survive. And those are the ones, and that's so many great programs. What they do at the end of the day is help kids think about their dreams and dream for the future and strive for the future. And then think about what are the things that I can do now in this moment in order to achieve some future state, and maybe that future state is a future for my whole country. And that's what Rand did. That's what Cat does. That's what the Movement for Children in Colombia does. That's what JAMA, another group in Burundi, does. They're groups that envision a different kind of a country, one where war and violence isn't prevalent, where divisions aren't complete, but where rather cooperative approaches to solving problems, fundamental basis of culture rooted in peace, or peace maybe rooted in culture, is the norm. And that's what they strive for. And that's what the most effective programs, I think, are able to achieve.
And on that note, I think we're going to wrap it up today. Michael Shipler, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the show today. Your amazing insights have been quite refreshing, and hopefully we can have you back sometime.
Yeah, thank you, Sean. Absolutely, anytime. I love doing this kind of thing. I really appreciate it.
All right. And if you'd like to get in touch with Michael, you can actually send an email to questions@conflictradio.org, and I'd be happy to forward any information on to him. Also, any resources, Michael, that people can get online to learn more about these issues?
Well, one of the great ones is, of course, UNICEF's website, www.unicef.org. Another one is the Coalition to Stop the Use of Child Soldiers, which is a very impressive organization, www.child-soldiers.org. And I've been working on developing one website on my own, actually, even outside of my work with Search for Common Ground. It's not up and running yet, but it should be hopefully by New Year's. It will be www.waraffectedyouth.org. And then lastly, you can learn about the work that we're doing in Search for Common Ground at www.sfcg.org.
Wonderful. Again, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, anytime. Thank you, Sean.
A few announcements to wrap up today. The Common Ground Film Festival continues this week at George Washington University. Tonight, the festival will screen a film called War and Peace, and special guests for the discussion to follow include Carl Inderfirth, former Assistant Secretary of State for South Asian Affairs. Catch the film and the discussion starting at 7 p.m. tonight. For more information, visit the website Michael just mentioned, Search for Common Ground, sfcg.org, for more information on the festival, which continues for the next couple of weeks. Next week on Conflict, Conversations about Conflict, we'll be joined in the studio by Carol Frampton and Kate Lavanche of the Common Ground Partnership. You may recall an interview we did a few weeks back regarding public perceptions of conflict. We had Carol in a pre-recorded interview there. This time she'll be back along with her colleague to share an exciting and rapidly growing initiative designed to get people talking about conflict via community dialogues. To hear about the success of the project and to find out how you can get involved, tune in to Conflict right here on WGMU Radio on 650 AM, GMU Cable Channel 22, or worldwide on WGMUradio.com. As always, you can listen to today's as well as previous programs and submit comments or questions by visiting www.conflictradio.org. I'm Sean Dunning. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.